Welcome to Monolithic, the podcast, where we explore diversity within Black experiences. I am Aaliyah Janae, and this episode is all about identity development, who you are, how do you see yourself, and all of your journey. I have a special guest here with me today, Brandon, aka Bishop, aka your favorite teacher, aka what up, your favorite coach, like all of the above, right?
Your favorite teacher's favorite teacher.
Okay. So thank you for reaching out and wanting to be a part of Monolithic. I love that. And you are now part of the Monolithic family. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. I'm happy to be here, and I'm excited to have this conversation. So thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Anytime. Like, honestly, you are always welcome to come back. If you need me for something, please don't hesitate to let me know.
Hey, let's hope you're saying that still in an hour.
Oh, we'll see. So we're just going to get started. Again, this is identity development. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How do you like identify yourself racially and or ethnically?
All right. So my name is Brandon. Nickname is Bishop. I actually got that when I was in college. First day on campus, I had an advisor who, my last name is Jakes. So I had an advisor who said, "You T.D. Jakes, son?" I'm like, "No, I'm not." But she started calling me Bishop and I couldn't shake it. And so that was like 2004. And so I've been Bishop ever since. I'm from small town Texas, where the federal government had to force the city to desegregate. I went to various schools. My elementary school was actually named Dixie Elementary. And it was, I would say, culturally and ethnically diverse, as was my middle school. But my high school was majority Black and Hispanic, which is not uncommon being from Texas. I had a very interesting experience at Texas A&M University, which is not known for its diversity. And I currently reside in Houston for the most part.
Okay, so, nice.
In terms of how I identify racially or ethnically, I am not the type of person that kind of gets upset on whether you call me Black or African-American. I feel like there is significance in both. I think that when you reference me as African-American, then you are playing into my heritage naturally, knowing that my people came from Africa, and I don't know which part of Africa I'm from. And so I just claim the whole continent, because I don't know. And then I feel like when you say Black American, you are really diving into the culture that our ancestors created by necessity, more or less, when you had all these people from different tribes and different countries who had to kind of blend and merge together based off the commonality of their skin tone and the oppression that they faced. And so When I hear Black American, I kind of think about all of the strength it required to survive those struggles, and the just the beauty of the color Black itself.
Yeah, you blacked out right now. They can't see it, but I see you.
It's my favorite color. I mean, like, low key. And then, you know, the podcast is Black and Gold, and I'm an alpha, so there he goes, Black and Gold. And then
I know
Black
out.
Black is definitely my favorite color. It used to be navy blue a long time ago, but then somewhere in college it switched. And that might actually have something to do with like that journey of really coming into touch and understanding more who I am as a Black person and a Black man, especially at a university where until recently, I'm not going to even say recently, that where diversity isn't necessarily celebrated, but it's been more just accepted.
Right.
If that makes sense, what I'm saying. So, I mean, I know the university has been trying to make a push-ish, but it's one of the more conservative universities here in Texas. And so you know how that goes when you start dealing with conservative politics and race.
Yeah. It's funny. I feel like you just had like a mid-thought.
Yeah.
Maybe it did happen in college. Okay.
Yeah, it did. It did. Man, I used to wear so much. I remember I wore so much navy blue that people were like, "Man, we used to think you was a Crip or something because you always wore blue all the time." I was like, no, man, I wouldn't. I like blue. But then I think just kind of as that as the transition occurred, and I just really started to just examine the color black and all of that it stands for, mm-hmm. and all that it represents, it became to me more than just a color, but it was more like a badge of honor.
Yeah, like empowering.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because it's black is so many things, right? Like the color black it can be sleek, right, and cunning, but it can be loud and bold and brash. Mm-hmm. It can be classy and classic, and then it can turn around and be ratchet. And it can be brilliant, and it can be subtle. Right. And then I kind of correlate that to what I think about our people. We can be all of those things, and all of those things are kind of what make us black. It's not even necessarily that you have to be all of those things or any of those things, but it's just a mixture of those things. Even when I talk with my students, I taught IPC, which is Integrated Physics and Chemistry. Mm-hmm. And so we start talking about pigmentation. And when you think about black, the color black, it is like every other color put together would give you black, right? And so like black is the combination of all things. So I kind of take that as like, as black people, we are all things and everything all at the same time.
Right.
So I think that's why my favorite color is black.
See, I love that little like realization, because sometimes we just do things and we don't understand or we don't think about how they came to form or just like right. The root of it all. And so I think it's important that you had that like moment of like, dang, you know what? That moment of realization.
I'm right.
Like, oh, this might be my favorite color.
That's probably why, because I'm black and we black and it's black and it's beautiful.
Okay.
And yeah, I never thought about that until like right. So about right now, in terms of like where it really began,
yeah,
you know, and I can clearly remember like that was the time period where that kind of that change in the favorite color happened. But then that was also the time period when I kind of had that shift.
So what was happening in college when you felt like that shift began?
We got to start.
Let's all the way. Let's start childhood. And then let's get to college.
So, what happened? So like I said, small town Texas, Tyler is where I'm from. And I know like early 70s, one of the schools named Robert E. Lee, which was recently just changed to Tyler Legacy, which I think was a joke in itself, because why would you change it and uphold the legacy, which is the reason why people want the name change right. in the first place. But I don't live there anymore, nor do I pay taxes there. My parents still do, so. But I don't really have no say. But, you know, this is a school that they were the Robert E. Lee Rebels, and they flew the Confederate flag and they played Dixie. And the people who were like the guardian of the whatever who are on the field, they wore like Confederate looking uniforms. And so the background of the city is extremely prejudiced and racist, as is East Texas in general. And I'm sure there are people who will probably argue, you know, that case, which is cool because you have your perspective, but you can't deny facts. And so if I'm not mistaken, I think the NAACP had to come through and mm-hmm. kind of help to end segregation as it was. And so that's kind of the background of the community I grew up in. That was the early 70s. I was born in 86. So, you know, we're looking at 10, 12 years removed from the outward expression of this loyalty to the Confederacy, mm-hmm. right? And what it stood for. And growing up, I don't remember, as a young person, I don't remember many overtly racist experiences. I think that's probably because I was fortunate enough to be kind of encapsulated in a community of people who looked like me and who believed in me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just one of those things you don't really realize until you step out of it. Yep. And then you look back at it and you're like, man, that's really what that was. And I can remember being recommended to be in the GT program, but it wasn't until I was in the third grade. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why I was recommended in the GT program in the third grade is because I had a black teacher. And I can remember being in the first grade, and I remember, you know, like they give you the spelling test weekly, right? Mm-hmm. And our teacher gave us a pretest before the real test. And I can, if you made 100 on a pretest, you didn't have to take the real test. And so I remember multiple times being on the computer during the actual spelling test, playing like number munchers or word munchers, because I had made hundreds on the spelling test in the first grade. But it wasn't until I had a Black teacher where I guess she felt like I was whatever qualified to be in the GT program. And so she recommended me, and I was able to you know, attain the alternative education to kind of create the thinker that I think I kind of am today. Right. And I don't know if that experience would have happened had I not had her in the third grade, you know. So my middle school years were pretty, I don't feel like they were out of place. I do remember a Black teacher, if I'm not mistaken, I think her name was Ms. Richardson, who was like our social studies, maybe in seventh grade. And I kind of felt like she held me to a different standard.
What do you mean by that?
You know how we do us. You see because you're in education. So you see someone who looks like you, who has this potential, and maybe there's an opportunity, a chance they're going to be off task or not live up to what they're supposed to be. And you ain't gonna cut them no slack. You stay on their head because you know that with the right guidance, they can get where they should be. And then with the wrong guidance, they can fall off track, right, and become a part of the system or a statistic, right? So I distinctly remember Ms. Richardson. I remember a counter with a sixth grade teacher, my sixth grade science teacher, go figure. I have a degree in chemistry. I teach science now. But a sixth grade science teacher, something happened, this kid did something to me and I hit him with a ruler and I got in trouble and the other kid didn't. And my mama had to pull up and she did the Black mama thing. You go wait outside, and then she closed the door. And I don't know what transpired in the room. I just know when I came out, everything was okay. And so my high school experience though was like drastically different because I went to the school on the north side of town, which is the Black side.
Okay.
And which is where I wanted to go to school. And I felt like I was smart. I felt like I was smart in the AP classes or whatever. And I felt like a lot of my friends and the people, like my teammates I played basketball with, and just folks in my class in general, were smart enough to be in those courses. They just didn't apply themselves.
Yeah, I understand that.
It kind of put me in a position where I almost felt like the token Black kid. Mm. Because like, why, if you are as smart as I am, because I know you are, because I hear you talk, you ain't dumb, just don't do nothing. I couldn't understand why these Black folks wouldn't do what they need to do to and show like how brilliant they were. And so it kind of turned me off in terms of like want to go to HBCU, because I kind of felt like I'm gonna get more of the same thing. And mind you, like I had no exposure or experiences with HBCUs. All I knew is Black school. And I go to a Black school, and this is what the Black people are doing in my school. So I can only imagine that at a college, it would be like that magnified.
A lot of people feel that way.
Yeah. And so I took a trip to A&M my senior year, and I thought the campus was beautiful. It felt like college, like when you watch the movies. And it just, and the open space and the greenery and, you know, the birds were chirping and the air was fresh and crisp. And there was kids tightrope walking across, not us, but there was kids tightrope walking across.
Okay.
I was like, see, this is like college, like what you see in the movies. And I remember we sat down because my family, we're all kind of nerdy. And so they had like the university campus map. We opened up the map, just kind of like, oh, here, this is where we are. Oh, this building's there. Oh, that's what that building is over there. And within 5 minutes, we had like 7 or 8 different people stop and be like, hey, are y'all lost? Y'all need help? Y'all, you know, do you need directions? Is there somewhere we can take you? And we was like, no, we're good. We're just like looking at the map. And it wasn't Black people. It was like white folks, mm-hmm. which is different. And I was like, all right, this might not be a bad spot. And so I show up on campus, right? You know, first day, first week of school. And I'm like shell-shocked because it's like a whole lot of white people. And I ain't never seen this many white people like in one
at
place.
At one time, right?
And like you walk into a classroom with 500 students mm-hmm. Like one of your weed out courses, and of the 500, there might be four of the black people in there. And that's kind of,
I can't imagine that.
It's like, we went in there, it's kind of like, what did I get myself into, right? But what it really did though, was it put us, the black population, in a position where, you know, like regardless of where you came from, your background, or your Greek affiliation or your religious affiliation, we came together, mm-hmm. and we had to create sort of a central hub of blackness to insulate and protect ourselves and nurture ourselves as we went through this world of college.
Right.
And for me, it was that exposure to, and I'm not saying I couldn't have got this at the HBCU, because maybe I could have, but I also believe that I think like our experiences are purposeful and intentional and helping us to become who we are. And so being able to be around so many different black people who were just different, it showed me like my type of black can be normal, and it is normal, and it's not the exception. And it helped me to, I think, connect with my identity as a black person more, because I had the opportunity to just be around different type of black people. A lot of the, and even, you know, even as black people, I think sometimes we buy into our own stereotypes, right?
Definitely.
It helped to kind of break the foundation of certain stereotypes about our people specifically, but then about like just the world in general. And I think that's one of the things that helps me to be an effective teacher, because I don't just look at my kids and just assume things about them. You know, I don't look at them and say, oh, she's smart because of X, Y, Z, without having a conversation with her, or he's this because of X, Y, Z, without being able to actually interact with them and experience how they behave.
Right.
And I think, like I said, I think that's just one of the things that's helped me to be able to connect with my kids of all races, religions, sexual preferences, genders, on a more grand scale, just because I have been exposed to the stereotype and have been the stereotype and broken the stereotype, and understand that the stereotype is really just a figment of your imagination created by media to make you feel like something is quote unquote normal. Right. And the only thing that I believe is normal is to be weird, because normal doesn't really exist.
Yeah, because they change all the time. It does. It's constantly changing. See, I got a whole lot of stuff to say real quick. First, I want to say, have you ever had a black male teacher growing up?
Yes, I had. My head basketball coach was actually the public speaking teacher.
Okay.
In high school. So I think I took that either my freshman or my sophomore year. So but that's the only one.
Wow, it's the only one?
Yeah, I only had one male black teacher.
So did that influence you to want to become a teacher? Because I'm sure.
No.
Really? Okay.
No, I became a teacher because I feel like I was good at working with kids. I remember going to college, I actually wanted to be a cardiovascular surgeon.
Oh,
is okay. What I wanted to be. My mom's a nurse, and so I've been able to shadow some cardiologists and whatever. And so that's what I thought I wanted to do. But I got a job working at the YMCA back home, mm-hmm. and then working at the Boys and Girls Club in both Bryan and College Station. And I really just love working with kids. It's a rewarding job.
Definitely.
To be able to help mentor and guide these kids who are overexposed, but don't have the understanding to kind of compartmentalize what they see as real or not real, as right. as genuine versus fake. And so I remember hearing somewhere in college, if you do something you love, then you never feel like you work again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it might have been right after I finished pledging. That's when I decided, you know, like for a fact, I want to be a teacher. And so I got my degree in chemistry, and I actually had my first teaching job before I graduated. And that's the rest is history. So that's been 2009, 13 years.
I love that, because I know I saw something on like social media that it talked about name the like, have you ever had a Black teacher? First, it was just Black teacher. Uh-huh. And I saw something else that was like, oh, have you ever had a Black male teacher? And like, I grew up in predominantly Black schools, so I had both all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't realize other people did not have that experience. And I'm like, I never had a Black teacher. It wasn't until I got to college, which was an HBCU, that I had three white teachers at once. So I had five classes. I had five classes. Three of my teachers were white, and I was floored.
They don't fit the script.
I'm like, yo, I've never
had y'all didn't put this in the pamphlet. This wasn't in the pamphlet. Y'all didn't tell me.
It was interesting. It was very interesting for me because I feel like I was the reverse of that experience. Uh-huh. And before that, I probably had less than seven white teachers my whole career, like from kindergarten up until.
That's crazy. Yeah, we're opposite. I had Miss Johnson in the third grade. In the fourth grade, I can't remember her name. But she was another Black teacher. She taught social studies and mm-hmm. history. Like, I remember a poem we learned in her class, and that we learned a preamble to the Constitution. But I don't remember her name. I couldn't remember her name to save my life, but I can see her as clear as day. In middle school, one, the social studies teacher in seventh grade.
Okay.
And then I had Coach Love, who was up like public speaking in high school. That was it, those four. And I, you know what? Now, I believe I had another one. I had an English teacher, Miss Sowell, freshman English. So I had five.
That's on one hand.
Something I've noticed though about education, I could be right, I could be wrong, I don't know.
I know it's your perspective, let us know.
It's like a lot of times you don't see a large number of Black teachers teaching advanced courses. And that's my experience, and I've taught at five different schools. Now the one school where everybody taught, well, two schools was predominantly Black students. You had a large Black staff, but in situations where it's the staff is mixed, I haven't seen a large number of Black teachers teaching advanced courses. And so as a student who was taking only advanced courses,
never had Black teachers.
I wouldn't have had the Black teachers.
See, again, mine is the opposite. It was the mix. It was a mixture of Miss Pearson. She did not play by her English. Like, she was hard.
Yeah.
We had a chemistry teacher named Ms. Boyles. I was so happy I didn't take her because everybody, even the smart kids, like failed her class because she was no joke. You don't get this chemistry. And I'm like, oh, I don't want her.
Right.
I did have like a calculus professor. He was like from India. So like East India, mm-hmm. East Asia. I did have a white AP teacher, Mr. Ruiz. But that's pretty much it. Like, again,
Mr. Ruiz, he was Hispanic.
But you know, but like, also know that like when you say Spanish, that's also people from Spain.
No, that's why I say so in Texas, we say Hispanic. So Hispanic is like our overarching word to include all of. Oh, okay. And then you have those two.
So, yeah. And so, that was interesting because.
You have those two.
Like, again, when we talk about like the diaspora, like even with that, there are white Spaniards, white Spanish people. There are Black Spanish people. There are people who are.
You know what? You're right. I give you that.
So it's like, yeah, that's just a culture and a language that does not define a racial ethnicity.
I agree. I give you that. That's interesting you say that. I had a conversation. There's a newer teacher on our campus who is, I want to say she's Filipino. Mm-hmm. But then again, she might be Cambodian. She's one of two. She told me, I don't remember. But we were talking about how, because she's younger. So she's closer to the age of our students, which is who I was, you know, like 10 or 12 years ago. But no more. I'm the old teacher now. But we're having a conversation about race because I sponsor the Black Culture Club on our campus, and she sponsors the club for our Asian and Pacific Islander students. And so we were talking about the dynamics of the relationship between people who identify as how she does and people who identify how we do. And so we were, you know, she was talking about how her parents were, are very like non-Black.
Anti-Black.
And, you know, I was like, you know, why? Like, tell me why. And she was explaining how her parents feel like Black people are loud and threatening and intimidating and all these things. I said, that's an interesting perspective. I said, because a lot of Black people, you'll talk to them and they will share experiences where people who are Asian or of Asian descent, I'll use that, treat Black people as less than and rude, and they're always suspicious. And so for us, it seems as if it's a response to the treatment that we've gotten from direct interaction. Whereas for others, for you all, it's y'all haven't ever had any interaction with us personally. So what you're really feeding into is propaganda, the spin that media has put on who we are as people. And she was like, that's true.
And it's so interesting because that's why I personally don't like the umbrella of people of color, because we may have a common oppressor. However, a lot of other people are anti-Black and they don't want to talk about that part. And again, it goes back to what you said, what you just said about like the media and all these things. However, they always have businesses in our communities.
They do.
So it's like
they getting up our money good.
So it's like one of those things of you don't respect us, you don't like us, however, you need us to thrive.
Right.
And that's the part to me that's a little bit frustrating. And we have to like continue to have those types of conversations around like the anti-Blackness within all those communities. Like I've been to Southeast Asia, I've been to Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand. And when I tell you that was one of the worst 17 days of my life.
Really?
Because of that, of those experiences of like blatant racism that I experienced.
Really? Like explain, you gotta give me an example.
Like I'm in the store and they're following me.
Yeah.
And we're talking like, oh, everybody here is American. Oh, even you? Like, you can't be American because of how I look. Like, I just couldn't be American. So the concept of being a Black American is like almost foreign, or people just don't understand it.
But that's because apparently people don't, because people associate American with white.
Whiteness.
They are synonymous.
And it's weird because like they had some amazing watermelon there.
Fire. Really?
But because I knew I was going to be the one of only Black people that they would ever see, I could not enjoy one of my favorite fruits because of the looks, and I didn't want to like perpetuate a stereotype.
I know, it sucks, don't it?
And that's a small example, but it was so like heartbreaking to me because I'm like, I can't
be me.
I had to fully represent the whole culture right now because they probably won't see another Black person for a while.
And that is, you know, I learned when I was at another school that there is a saying, if you will, or a poem called The White Man's Burden. Have you ever heard of it?
Mm-mm.
I'm gonna Google it and read it real quick. And it's by Rudyard Kipling, which sucks because Rudyard Kipling is one of the, his poem is one of the poems that we use when you're, you know, pledging.
Okay.
But it basically talks about, it's too long to read.
Need a little quick, synopsis.
It talks about how the white man is supposed to be the savior of all, more or less.
So what's the burden of?
And they take that as this, it almost gives them like this birthright stature
Oh, gotcha.
Of being at the pinnacle of the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. But then, like, when I listen to you say that, right?
Uh-huh.
It kind of put a spin on it. And I was like, that's the Black man's burden, right? The Black man's burden is to, it seems like it's to educate.
Always.
All the time.
Always. Black people.
About what we are and what we're not. And the fact that we are not all the same. Like, you talking about eating watermelon? For me, that wouldn't have been an issue because I don't like watermelon. Can't stand watermelon.
No, but, and I love the seeds. Like, the active part of taking the seeds out are just...
Really?
I love that. Yeah. Then I'm like, I have to, like, can you make it into a juice for me? So I can't...
Really?
Like, it got to the point, because also, like, it was hot. So I'm like, let's get down to the nutritional value of watermelon. Like, I'm staying hydrated. I'm full. I'm getting fiber. Like, mm-hmm. I want that because it's hot. But I can't even enjoy it because of what it looks like.
I know. And it sucks that the captures and the depictions of our people from the late 1800s and the early 1900s and even into the 40s and 50s, and those things are still perpetuated.
Yeah. Even when I was in Thailand. Even when I was in Thailand, they had a the caricature of, like, the Sambo images. And I'm like, at this time it was 2019. So I'm like, that's
crazy.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, they learn about us from pictures.
They would just take pictures of you.
I've heard of that.
Everything. It got to the point, like, I would hide my face. I would tell people, like, don't do that. Like,
wow.
Every day. The moment I set foot on the soil, I had a little kid pointing at me. So the moment I got out of the airport, it started.
That's crazy.
And we don't talk about that enough.
We don't. I agree. We don't. Somewhere in the conversation, I had a thought. Oh, we were talking about, it's still online.
Mm-hmm.
How when you look at the quote unquote hierarchy of American society.
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly in this 15, 16, 17, 1800s, 1900s, even still, you know, whiteness is the pinnacle of the hierarchy, right? Because it's the power structure is created that way, so they are the pinnacle of the power structure, right? And there's a book I was introduced to by one of my coworkers. She teaches history, and she happens to be Black, and so we have. It's nice to be able to have those deep historical conversations. Even though I teach chemistry, I like history, mm-hmm. and I like to watch documentaries and stuff like that. But she put me on this book. It's called Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. And what it talks about, it compares the caste system in India,
mm-hmm.
to the caste system that exists in America.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that really stuck out to me in the book is said that Dr. King, when he was alive, he visited India. And, you know, the caste system in India, you have the people who are at the top, whatever, whatever. But then at the very bottom, you have the untouchables, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they considered Dr. King one of the untouchables. And he was like, why would they consider me an untouchable? I'm an American. But then he realized, like, in my country, I am the bottom of the bottom. I am the untouchable. And so when you start to think about how immigrants move here to America, one of the things that they try and do is to not align themselves in any way with Blackness.
Exactly.
Because they don't see the advantage socially, which becomes financially and economically,
mm-hmm.
to being tied to being Black. And it's actually, Cass was in Oprah's book club.
Yeah. So
it's dope. It's a good read.
I'm happy you said that because it's almost any immigrant too. It doesn't matter where you're coming from. And people don't think about how there's privilege in being able to have a home country and then come over here. And then you still have opportunities set up for you to advance versus people who've already been here. And we have layers and layers of obstacles preventing us from growing and developing.
Right.
Like, we talk about, like, oh, segregation is over, but redlining and zoning is still things. They just
very
same
strong.
Game, different players.
That's it.
Same, they renamed strong. It, but it's still happening and occurring. And I feel like sometimes with some immigrants, they don't quite understand the Black American struggle, mm-hmm. partially because it's just different system. But also, I feel like sometimes they don't want to understand because of what you said of there's no advancement. it's like, oh, you have it easy. You're in America. You should be fine. But it's not. It's way more complicated than that.
Unfortunately, you know. And then you have, there's a huge conversation right now about CRT, mm-hmm. critical race theory, which most people who are talking about don't understand really what it is. It's become a buzzword for racism and making other people
feel bad
about the history that their grandparents actively participated in.
And which they still benefit off of today.
100%. Mm-hmm. And I lost my thought on that. I was going somewhere with that and it just went whoop.
Yeah, you were talking about, let me see if I can fill it in. Maybe something about how every time we talk about race or anytime that we talk about the treatment of us in the as a people, it's always like, stop, like, no, let's keep this good American dream. Let's keep up and uphold some of these things that America is known to be.
That it's supposed to be, right. And it just, I think it sucks that there is such a push, especially now in Texas, I'm across the South, but in Texas specifically, to not show complete history mm-hmm. for fear of making a group uncomfortable when in those same moments in history, a group of people that look like this weren't just made to feel uncomfortable. They were threatened with their lives and their livelihood.
And that's the thing. I feel like, you know how when people get mad when we say like Black Lives Matter?
Yeah.
I feel like because they know, or when you say like, oh, I'm pro-Black, they know because everything that's pro-white is like
anti-Black.
It's anti-Black. Yes. So they feel like when we're saying that, we're saying the same thing that they're saying.
Right.
And that's not it. And I feel like when we are talking about history, teaching the whole truth then makes them look like the bad guys that they were and are.
Right.
But again, they don't want to acknowledge like you had to murder, steal, and lie to get what you had. Because then how can you truly say you are successful?
We were better. We were smarter.
How can you say that you're all these things when all that had to happen?
Yeah.
So it's just a cover up for them to like continue their, I don't even like to call it supremacy because to me it's fragility.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain fear there. Because they realize like if the culture changes, then the status that they have changes.
Mm-hmm.
And who wants a more difficult battle? Nobody. But if you believe in karma or as a man soweth, so does he reap, it inevitably somewhere in here the tide has to turn.
They're gonna try to keep controlling it until they can't no more.
Well, and you know, in our country, which is a capitalist society, the one who has the money has the power and controls the narrative. And I think that's why it's important that we not only that, I think we need to make two pushes. We need to make economic pushes and we need to have our own money, and then we need to make political pushes. And you know, people will try and make us believe that Black people don't do politics, which historically is inaccurate. Because if you look at history, up until 1865, we couldn't participate in politics for on a large part.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a 10 or 12 year period right after that, where we have Reconstruction, where you have your first senators and state representatives, and you have a lot of office being held for the first time by Black people. And we are voting like crazy, which caused white Americans to, especially in the South, to get scared and be afraid and have to form hate groups like the KKK to forcibly stop Black people from voting by killing and terrorizing, lynching, and all of these things. So it's not that we have never cared about politics. It's just that we have never had a real fair chance
at
being a part of the political conversation.
That's why we need to tell our own stories. Because
I agree.
If we allow them to tell it, again, it's, oh, nobody's, even though I am one of those people who hate politics because I don't like a two-party system, One is overt, other one is covert.
I'm gonna say they same party.
So, you know, what did they say? It's one bird, two different wings, or something like that. That's how I personally feel. But I also do a lot of research on other candidates that could possibly work for me. But that's the thing. I feel like we should know more about the system, know our options, know who else is out there, because just having a two-party system, like, when people are like, oh, the lesser evil, I'm like, evil is evil. I don't want the lesser. I don't want neither. And again, it's that narrative of, oh, Black people don't do this, they don't do that. I'm like, who are these Black people that you're surveying? Where is the data?
Exactly.
Like, give me the numbers. Americans.
we surveyed 100 Americans, and these are the results.
What 100 did you talk to?
Y'all didn't come anywhere where we stay.
Because no, this is not accurate. So I think that a lot of the conversations, I had another point that I wanted to talk about really quick. Going back to our HBCU, because, you know, I'm an HBCU graduate, and I have.
As is my wife, so, you know, I.
She's from Prairie View, right?
She went to Prairie View, so big A&M system. We in the same system, you know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. So big shout outs to PV. No hate, so, all love.
When you were talking about how you met different types of Black people, to me, when I went to HBCU, that's the first time that I fully understood the definition of diversity. Because I was at a space where I had two of the same identities. Mm-hmm. I went to Spelman, so that's a single sex institution. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, there are women here, and they Black, or they are of African descent, or something to that of that nature, right?
Right.
So we couldn't rely on things like a BSU or anything like that, because the whole school is a BSU. The whole school is all of that. So when you start to think about, like, okay, what else do we have in common now? Because we already established we both Black and female.
Yeah, I'm Black. So what else is there?
So what else is there? So then I started thinking about, like, I was around a lot of affluent Black girls. So I started thinking about, like, socioeconomic status. So what does that mean? And then just within my class alone, I think all 50 states were represented.
Wow.
And we had people international from, like, some of, like, Oprah's daughters were in my class.
Really?
Like, you know, like, how Oprah had that school in South Africa? Or, like, those schools? Yes. Yeah, some of her daughters were in my graduating class.
Wow.
We had people from, like, did a domestic exchange, or not domestic, a foreign exchange, that were Black women from the UK come down. And so that's the moment where I really was like, there's so much more to diversity than just race.
Right.
Because, again, we all the same. Like, even when it came time to consider, like, possibly pledging, what else are you? Because you already have Black women.
Right.
What sets you apart? What makes you stand out in order to be a part of any organization?
That's crazy. That's a crazy thought.
Yeah.
To be. I never thought about that. Like, as an HBCU experience, that's crazy.
You know what? My best friend is from Sacramento, California. We met at Spelman. And when I tell you, we were completely opposite in every way. Mm-hmm. Personality is different. We look different. Different parts of the country. Just everything different. And with her being from California, and specifically, like, Sacramento, she grew up around a lot of Russians. And she didn't have a lot of Black experiences. Whereas me, all I knew was Blackness.
Right.
But we are coming together, and she's learning from me. She's like, oh, I never knew that. And I'm like, I learned that in third grade. In the class, everybody who goes to Spelman, they have to take a class called African Diaspora in the World, so ADW. Good. That's the class that I thrived in, because I'm like, this is my element. I'm learning Black history. This is all I've ever done. For her, she struggled so bad. And I just, for the life of me, couldn't understand, like, why are you struggling? This is your
issue. She had never been exposed to any of that.
She'd never been exposed to it. Even just around foods, because, like, I'm vegan, but at the time I was vegetarian. I haven't ate meat in 10 years now. She was not eating no vegetables. Yeah. She was not eating no vegetables. Her favorite meal was hamburger helper and biscuits. Hey. And I'm like, girl, where's the bacon? I'm like, that's what you want?
Was it cheese plain macaroni?
I don't know. Oh. None of all of that. But the point that I'm getting at was that we were so different.
Right.
But people would just saw us like, oh, yeah, Black women, cool. Nah, we were completely different. But those differences kind of brought us together, and we constantly learned from each other. And that was a repetitive theme, a continuous theme throughout my 4 years of like, dang, I'm meeting all these people from everywhere.
Right.
And all of our experiences are so different, but we ultimately have the same goal of graduating from Spelman.
And so, you know, that kind of reminds me of conversations I've had with my wife about her experiences at Prairie View, where you know, they talk about it was a safe space to just kind of be Black and explore life without being hindered by the complexion of your skin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a moment to kind of be free and to breathe. And I think had I known more about like the history of Prairie View and its significance culturally, then I probably would have considered it more. But I just kind of felt like at A&M, it was a constant uphill battle.
Mm.
It was constantly being self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
Because you always, like every interaction, you got a question.
Mm-hmm.
And you never really just get a moment to just breathe and be, and not even bask in your melanated identity, but to kind of just be introspective in terms of just who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had moments of that when we kind of isolated ourselves as a culture, you know, but that was kind of like, it's really like today, like you go home, you go to work into this world of non-Blackness, and then you come back home to your safety net.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how it was. Like, we would, you know, we live together, we'd be together, we kick together, but when it's time to go to class, we had to put the mask on to go into the world. And then when we came back amongst our people, right, and we had the DMS, which is Department of Multicultural Services, which was for us, it was like a safe haven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I get in that spot, I can let my hair down, so to speak, you know, and I ain't really got none. talk with, you know, adults and young adults who are like advisors and have held certain positions just about our experiences. And I think that a part of that experience and having to live like that for so long is kind of why I am how I am now in terms of dealing with race, especially at work. I've been at several schools where students have come to me about issues that they've had with other teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of just be ready to go. Like, okay, I mean, who said it? What they say? Do you want me to go talk to them or not? Because I don't mind. And they'll be like, no, don't say nothing. I'll be like, okay, I got you. And I go talk to them anyway. Just because I can relate to what it feels like to be a minority. All right. And this specific part of the conversation goes beyond race. But I know what it's like to be the minority in a place where people don't understand you, but then to be afraid of speaking out because you don't want to deal with the backlash. And so I feel like I have been put in the position to be the voice for these kids who can't say it themselves. They won't tell their parents because they're afraid if they go tell their parents, then the teacher's going to try and get them back on the back end.
Right.
You know, and so I've gotten in trouble for it. I've definitely I've put myself on the radar, but just because I'm like, in the end, especially when I'm thinking about education, I'm not here to make friends. Like, it'd be nice to get along with the people I work with, but in the end, I'm here for the kids, right? And them being able to grow up with a sense of self-worth.
Yes, sir.
And to leave my classroom feeling empowered.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond chemistry, I know my class is hard, as you alluded to earlier. But I want them to, when they leave my class, I want them to be able to be critical thinkers, and I want them to be confident in who they are, even if they suck at chemistry, right? Like, I tell all my kids, you might not be the best at chemistry, but you are brilliant and you are smart in something.
Exactly.
And I want you to find that something, because that something, once you find it, that something is going to be what allows you to change the world and change your life. And so that's kind of they always hear me, Coach, when am I use this? Probably never. Like, you ain't gonna ever calculate.
At least you're honest.
Yo, what are we lying for? You think I never calculate grams? I said, but you know, one day you might be a business owner where you produce a product and you might get a large order that of more supply than what you have. And you need to be able to work backwards from the amount of product you need to produce so you can figure out how much you need to start with so that you can buy. So at least you don't overbuy or underbuy and put yourself in a bind on the back end.
That's right.
And that's normally enough for them to be like, all right, I'll try again. All right, cool. Let's run.
But that's real. At least you give them, like, I think that's kind of what's missing in education is the relational, or like the, how can I apply this to everyday life? Like,
right.
Application part of it all. And I'm happy that students now are having more teachers like that, because what do you really learn in school besides learning how to follow directions?
Well, you know, if we really get into the educational system and how antiquated it is, basically the Industrial Revolution. And here we are in the digital and information age. We got an 8-hour school day because they had an 8-hour work day, and you got summers off. Because, you know, we could get into all that, but then you the politics, and I'm not trying to say nothing's going to get me fired. So,
you know, we good. We ain't going to go into that. So, no, let's wrap it up then. And of course, I will always bring you back so we can have another discussion.
All right. Well, I have to have a different occupation then we can go in and go in. You still got to play the game.
Oh, unfortunately. Ooh, but before we get off, what you just said made me think about something. When people talk about HBCUs, they always say, like, oh, that's probably not the real world. They're not preparing you for the real world. And that always bothered me, because I'm like, it's just 4 years of your life.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot more life to live.
Mm-hmm.
And people fail to realize that a lot of companies come and recruit at these HBCUs.
Right.
And you still have internships, you still have jobs, you still have other things that you are still interacting with the real world, quote unquote, white people. That's what it's code.
That, yeah, that's what it means. It's code.
Just code for. And so when I always tell people, like, it's not what you think, as far as like, oh, you never be, half the girls I knew, that was their first time around black people.
Yes. I've had students like that. At one of the schools I worked at where the racially on paper is like 30-30-30, I had kids who were itching, dying to go to HBCU because they want to be around more black people, mm-hmm. to have the black experience, to get more in touch with who they are. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when they talk to me, they swore I went to HBCU, and I'm like, no, I went to A&M. They're like, you did? I'm like, yeah, I did. I said, but I think it's because I went to A&M. I think that's why I am how I am. And so I think that we all take different roads,
mm-hmm.
to still get to the same point.
Yep.
And that for me was my road. Whereas for my wife, she took a different path to get to where she is. But we still, in the end, in terms of talking about blackness and how we feel about blackness, we still got to the same point.
Makes sense.
But I think that was the path I had to take. I think God had to put me in a closed environment so that I could really get to know and take in these experiences of people from different parts of the state and the country and different countries. I actually learned a lot, you know, dealing with like students from Africa, and not to put all, you know, all the countries lumped together. But I was having a conversation with her. I think she was from Ghana. I don't remember her name.
I'm getting there.
But one of the things she was saying, you know, we were just talking about how like Africans don't like black people. And she was like, well, yeah, that's kind of true. And she kind of went into the, you know, the reasons behind. And I was like, but she was like, at the same time, like being able to be here and being around black Americans, I'm learning that a lot of those things aren't true. And I was like, you know, that's cool, you know, because I see y'all as black. I don't see y'all anything as anything different. As far as I'm concerned, we all got the same fight together. And so it was just interesting to be able to have cultural conversations even amongst other black people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who didn't even necessarily identify as black. Man, if you hadn't read Cash, you gotta go read Cash.
I
was mad. I was mad for a few days. I ain't gonna lie. It had me feeling like Roots. Have you seen the Emmett Till story? I mean,
no, I don't plan on it either.
Mm.
Nah, I'm over Black trauma.
Well, so with the women of the movement, I would, yeah, it's Black trauma. I ain't gonna even say
it. Yeah, I'm over it. No.
But I knew the story of Emmett Till, but I didn't know the depths in which his mom went to try and make the impact she made on the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was, I thought it was interesting. It had me mad too, though. I ain't gonna lie.
Some stuff, I'm like, I'm just gonna have to, anytime I watch movies like that, I have to go back and Google anyway, because whenever it's in Hollywood, I already know.
You know they're gonna take some artistic liberty.
And dramatize. And they're like, based on a true story, all that crap.
Not the real story.
Not the real story. No. So I'm just like,
so then have you watched the documentary 13th on Netflix?
No, I don't intend to. I have no intentions on it.
13th ain't traumatic. It's traumatic.
It depends. Either. It depends on who you're talking to, because if you have family who've been in the system, it could be traumatic.
Yeah. It I have a cousin that's, he's doing life, and it helped me to understand how his trial and how that stuff went, how it did. It was crazy, but
yeah, I'm okay. Like,
she said, no, I'm good on that.
I live in a Black body every day. I don't need to be reminded that people think we ain't shit, and that's really? that's how I feel about it.
They don't need it. Yeah.
Like, of course, and I'm definitely a history person, but to me, like, I'm more interested in knowing that we're beyond this. Like, yes, this is part of our story, but it's not our whole story. And I just don't want to focus on that.
That's crazy. Because I wrote this, because Valentine's Day, I have my brand or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Valentine's Day. And I was like, I was thinking about the stuff I was going to do for my wife. And I was like, man, my wife really likes cards, right? And I was like, man, what if somebody wrote like a love letter to the Black community, right? A love letter to Black America. And I actually sat and wrote one. And I liked it a lot. It's long, so I ain't gonna read it to you, but I'll send it to you if you wanna read it. But it was, I just felt like because of so much, because all the things we've been through, and like you, listening, you talk about the trauma, like I felt like we just needed to hear something good about ourselves. Like, we just need to know that you are loved and you are worthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, like, that's what you're talking about when you're talking about love. I think it's helping someone realize their self-worth
big time, because every day, every time we look around, something is telling us to hate ourselves,
right?
And
so I wrote that joint, and then I shared it with my Black Culture Club on Monday, and they were like, oh yeah. I was like, okay, I guess that's a winner. All right, I'm gonna send it out to my email list and see what they think. So
yes, send it over. And since you already started talking about your business, can you tell us a little bit about your business, any other projects that you're working on?
Sure. So outside of teaching and coaching and tutoring.
I told y'all, yeah. I remember the intro. I said all those things.
I have a brand. It's called State of Mind Collections. And the idea of it came from an interaction I had with a Black student at a majority Black high school, first day of school, as his chemistry teacher. This kid looked me in my face and told me that chemistry wasn't for Black people. And I was kind of like taken aback because I'm Black. I got there in chemistry. So what you trying to tell me? Either my degree fake or I ain't Black. Which one is it? And then there was like the thing that tripped me out was like there were students in the class that agreed with him. And I am the type of teacher that if something come up and I feel like we need to have a conversation about it, we're going to pause chemistry for a moment and we're going to converse about what we need to talk about. And then we're going to get back on chemistry and move on. Right. And so in the course of our conversation, what I found out is that these kids who are in this Black school, predominantly Black neighborhood, really all Black neighborhood, had never been exposed to Blackness beyond the stereotypes. So being smart wasn't cool. Being good at certain types of instruments wasn't cool, but it It's only because they lack knowledge in our history, in our heritage, in our culture. And so I think that's kind of where the seed was planted for me to try and educate our community more. It was just kind of trying to figure out like what's the apparatus? What's the medium that should be used to educate, to enlighten, and to empower?
That's right.
And so then I got into like custom apparel with my brother-in-law. And then it kind of, I think I was at Walmart. And I kind of had an epiphany. Like I saw a whole bunch of people with t-shirts. And I realized everybody who wore a t-shirt, the shirt means something to them. And not only does it mean something to them, but when I read the message on the shirt, I might chuckle and laugh. Oh, that's funny. Or I might relate, or I'm going to be, oh, he's one of them. But whatever it was, the message always elicited some sort of response, right? Mm-hmm. Not only just for the people who was wearing it, the person who was wearing it, but the people who were exposed to it also. Right. And so that's kind of when I decided to use shirts as the medium to spread the message. Yeah, that dropped on me. And that's kind of where State of Mind Collections was born. And so each message is something that I feel in my spirit. When I read it, I feel it in my spirit. When I put the shirt on and see it in a mirror, I feel it. And you know how there's certain things that kind of, they touch you and you can kind of feel the shift in your mind. Like I feel like this, the shirt I got on right now says, claiming everything my ancestors were denied. That's right. And so that's how I kind of went about my day. Like with this audacity, like everything they could not have, I'm coming to get. Period. Everything that they were denied, I'm claiming it as mine. And that's just really what I want to do with our community is encourage us and equip us with the knowledge that will empower us to reach our potential. And I think the best thing about my brand for me personally is when I wear it out to stores or whatever, and to get the eyes from our people and to get the nods or the hey, dot, hey. Or, you know, if they old school, right on, brother. and just being able to have that, that momentary connection, especially when some of the messages, I'm not going to say they're coded, but if you're not in touch with us,
those who get it.
Right. And I feel like those are like the best ones, right? Where it's just that you can walk by someone else and they look at it and they kind of, you can see they look perplexed. But then you walk by someone with a little melanin and they get it and you're like, yeah, that's for you. I wore this just for you specifically. And so that's what the brand is about. It's just about educating, enlightening, and empowering our people to be the best we can be. I want you to be the blackest black you can be, whatever that black is. Yes, I want you to know that you are worthy and that you have a place in the world, that you are important, and that you can create the change and have the impact. I want our kids to know that they can literally do and become whatever it is they want to be. And sometimes it just takes one encounter, one message, one shirt to literally change the course of history.
That's right.
And that's what we're trying to do.
Perfect. So where can they find your t-shirts?
You can go to www.stateofmindcollections.com. And the reason it's named State of Mind is because I believe that if we can have a shift in our state of mind and how we think, then we can create the culture shift that we really want to see.
That's real.
When we're talking about Black Lives Matter, if you change that thought in your mind, then you can make it where Black Lives Matter.
You also have any like Instagram handles or where can they find?
Oh, IG, State of Mind, State of Mind, the number four, the culture. But I really suck at posting on social media. I need to hire somebody to do that. I'm really bad at it.
Yeah, State
of Mind. I'm excited, man. My wife, she decided she's going to start working with me on it. So I'm super excited because she is, you know how they talk about like being opposites? Like my wife is the yin to my yang.
And that's how it's got to be.
And so I'm excited because I know she's she is the bah 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 type, you know, like A B C X Y Z, bang bang bang. Whereas I'm more the creative.
So you're the visionary, and she's the implementer.
Yes, yes, 100%, 100%. So I'm excited because I think she's gonna help it go to the next level.
We're excited. Absolutely. Please. I would definitely be supporting soon. So look out for me coming through.
No doubt. No doubt.
Also, listeners, please be sure to support State of Mind Collections. And thank you for listening to Monolithic, the podcast, again, where we explore diversity within Black experiences. We hope that you learned something. If something that we said resonated with you, please let us know in the comment section of our IG, which is Monolithic_the podcast. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for future episodes. Peace and gratitude.
Love, peace, and chicken grease. Monolithic.